Hello there. Today is Friday, September 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the top Democrats hoping to challenge President Trump's re-election face-off in their third debate.
My plan would do that. Your plan would not.
They do not have to buy in. They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago.
Israel's prime minister makes a bold statement about his plans for Gaza if he's reelected. Also ahead, Madonna sets a strict new policy for fans attending her concerts ahead of her upcoming Madam X tour. It's all on today's International Edition. Democratic presidential frontrunner Joe Biden clashed with progressive challengers Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders on health care in a debate Thursday that defending Obamacare and challenging them to be honest about the cost of their plans, with the first 10 Democratic candidates sharing the debate stage for the first time in Houston. The contenders spent more time expressing their shared opposition to Republican President Donald Trump and pared back some of the bickering that marked the first two debates this summer. Joining us now live in studio for more analysis is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, overall takeaway?
Well, I think it was a spirited debate on many fronts, and Joe Biden remains at the center of it. He did seem to have a fair bit of energy tonight. A number of people commented on this as the debate was going on. As you know, some of his past debates have been a little bit inconsistent. But the big sort of takeaway was going to be, how was he going to contrast himself with particularly Elizabeth Warren, who's been rising in the polls? She is now challenging Bernie Sanders for second place behind Biden. And Warren did not seem to get as much attention in this debate, did not seem to stand out as much as in her previous two debates. So I think for the moment, the general takeaway will be that the top sort of contenders, Biden, Warren, and Bernie Sanders, though maybe to a lesser degree, kind of maintain their positions. And a number of the rest of the Democrats on stage, though, did a pretty good job themselves. Whether that will help them, it's too early to say.
Let's play a little recap of some of the moments that stood out that people are talking about. Here is Vice President Joe Biden addressing Senator Bernie Sanders.
My friend from Vermont thinks that the employer is going to give you back if you negotiate his union all these years, got a cut in wages because you got insurance. They're going to give back that money to the employee?
Matter of fact, they will.
Well, let me tell you something. For a socialist, you got a lot more confidence in corporate America than I do.
What do you think?
Clash over health care there. This is a signature issue that's dividing them. Biden has a more modest sort of follow-on on the Obama proposal, Health Care Act. And, you know, Sanders and Elizabeth Warren favor what's called Medicare for All. It's a much more sweeping, costly, government-run program that would basically eliminate private health insurance. So there is, you know, controversy and concern. Amy Klobuchar is another one who doesn't favor this, and some of the other contenders also have issues with it. So Biden was trying to put the more liberal contenders on the defensive about the cost of their plans.
The word socialist, that probably was intentional, would you say?
I guess so. But Bernie Sanders doesn't run away from that title, never has.
Right. I think that's something, a strategy Republicans may try to use. People are afraid of the word, thinking that it's, you know.
Right. And that's one of the driving fears in the Democratic field, is by going too far left, they will set themselves up for being attacked in the general election by President Trump.
Well, there were also lots of disagreements on how to resolve the issue of health care coverage, as you just were talking about, including a moment that's getting a lot of attention that people think may have been a bit mean-spirited, comments by Julian Castro.
They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
To buy in, if she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago? Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago? I mean, I can't believe that you said 2 minutes ago that they had to buy in, and now you're saying they don't have to buy. You're forgetting that.
I said anyone like your grandmother who has no money.
We need a healthcare system.
You're automatically enrolled.
Automatically enrolls people, regardless of whether they choose to opt in or not. If you lose your job, for instance,
his health care plan would not automatically enroll you. You would have to opt in. My health care plan would. That's a big difference. I'm fulfilling the legacy of Barack Obama, and you're not.
I'll be surprised to him.
Yeah, that was quite an exchange. And I think the issue there was, did Castro go too far in pushing, kind of raising the issue of Biden's age? He's 76. He said some things on the campaign trail at times where he seems confused. And you could hear that the interesting thing there was the reaction of the crowd at the
Were they cheering or booing?
No, I think they were kind of gasping a little bit. They were taken aback.
They weren't comfortable.
And some of the commentary already about this has been critical of Castro going there. But look, Biden's the front runner. He's going to have to take flack. And people like Julian Castro are on the outer edges of this field right now at 1 or 2%. They need to find a way to get into the game.
All right. Well, a lot of them also did decide to go after the current president, Donald Trump, who is not doing so well in the polls these days. Here's Senator Kamala Harris on the string of recent mass shootings we've seen here.
It is traumatizing our children. El Paso and Beto, God love you for standing so courageously in the midst of that tragedy. You know, people asked me in El Paso, they said, you know, because I have a longstanding record on this issue, they said, well, do you think Trump is responsible for what happened? And I said, well, look, I mean, obviously he didn't pull the trigger, but he's certainly been tweeting out the ammunition.
That was a good line, catchy.
Yeah, and she was not alone in targeting President Trump. We heard comments, say, from Beto O'Rourke talking about accusing the president of being a white supremacist. Cory Booker accused him of being a racist. And we should point out the president has repeatedly denied these allegations in the past, especially in the wake of the recent shootings that they're talking about. Interesting there about Kamala Harris. She is now focusing her fire on Donald Trump. In the very first debate, she went after Joe Biden. She seems to have changed tactics there.
Right. It seemed like it might not have worked. At first, it gave her a bump in the polls, and then it sort of
And
went
she
the
faded.
Other way.
She had a big fade after the second debate.
And, of course, we know immigration is a huge issue here right now in this country, and the president's hardline policies getting a lot of attention. Andrew Yang took advantage of that, dealing directly with the Trump administration's policies on immigration.
I think we have to compete for talent, and I am the opposite of Donald Trump in many ways. He says, build a wall. I'm going to say to immigrants, come to America, because if you come here, your son or daughter can run for president. The water is great, and this is where you want to build a company, build a family, and build a life. This country has been a magnet for human capital for generations. If we lose that, we lose something integral to our continued success, and that is where I would lead as president.
He is a pretty straight shooter there. He really seems to be gaining a bit in sort of people finding out who he is.
He has a fairly resilient following, and he had a pretty good crowd in the hall there because they would cheer him on quite a bit. He's got some unique pitches. One of them is he's going to give everybody $1,000 if he gets elected as sort of an income dividend. But, you know, he's a businessman. That's not always the case in the Democratic field where you find someone from the private sector. He's got a following among younger people. And, yeah, he's made a splash, so to speak. Is he able to break into the top tier? Probably not right now. But if he hangs around long enough, who knows what could happen.
So overall, would you say anybody advanced themselves or hurt themselves?
Some of the
slip?
Lesser candidates, Cory Booker is getting good reviews. Klobuchar did fairly well. Beto O'Rourke maybe made a little bit of a comeback. But again, these are all candidates in the single digits. Will this matter much? Is it going to be incremental? Is it still about Biden versus Warren versus Sanders, and then maybe with Harris and Pete Buttigieg hanging on there in fifth place? Did the narrative change all of that? It's hard to say right now. Maybe not. And so we now look forward, I guess, to the next debate or set of debates in mid-October.
I guess for some it's do no harm, not necessarily even wanting to get ahead.
Good way to think of it.
All right, that's VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone. We thank you so much, as always.
Sure.
Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. Venezuela's minister calls for U.S. sanctions or calls U.S. sanctions economic terrorism. House Democrats are struggling to define impeachment and their investigation. A faltering Wyoming coal industry is betting on emissions capture breakthrough, and the House panel has subpoenaed the top U.S.-Afghan negotiator. Find expanded coverage of these stories and lots more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will soon learn whether he will be given another turn as his country's general election comes up next week. In recent days, he's renewed a promise to supporters of a vow to annex settlements in the occupied West Bank. Some say the move could end any remaining hope of creation of a two-state solution with an independent Palestinian state living peacefully alongside Israel. Joining us to talk more about this and what it could mean is Israel expert and author of the just-released book Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century, Rabbi Terry Bookman. Rabbi, thank you for being with us. What's your take on Netanyahu's annexation promise?
Number one, the possibility that strikes me front and center is that this may just be part of a political stunt. He's running for office. He's in a very tight race. He's trying to grab some seats from right-wingers who are challenging him. And so this might appeal and might create enough seats to form a coalition without legally. But if it's more than that, it's on some levels, it's creating a reality, what has de facto become the reality. In other words, when President Trump recognized Jerusalem as the capital, although the real embassy is in Tel Aviv and still exists, most Israelis think of Jerusalem as their capital. The Golan Heights, most Israelis don't believe that that's ever going back. And this strip on the Jordan River, on the West Bank of the Jordan River, is actually controlled by the Israeli military today. But creating it as annexation under the cover of President Trump doesn't change the ultimate reality for Israel. And Israel is still confronted by the four basic choices that it had after 67 war. And that is, number one, create two separate states with recognized borders and security for both, which is what most of the world expects and wants. Two, to create one fully democratic state with almost equal Arab and Jewish populations, which could alter the very nature of the Jewish state. Three, they could create one state, but without full rights for the Palestinians, which would be tantamount to apartheid. Or four, continue the occupation or control, whatever word you want to use, it still means the same of the Palestinians, which threatens the democratic status of Israel. And right now it appears that Israel is continuing to choose number four. That is, we'll continue to control this piece of land and the lives of those who live in it, and without full rights, they're not citizens of any country, and see what happens.
Do you think that he was basically just sort of making the statement to appeal to a certain set of voters, and that this would be something that would be much harder and more complicated to actually achieve in real life?
Well, I think it is appealing to a certain set of voters. Plus, it's appealing to a percentage of supporters in the United States. There's about 20% of American Jews support a kind of a right wing, it's our land from the river to the sea. And those are financial supporters often, symbolized by Ambassador Friedman. So it may very well be that. Does it really change anything? Is it just language? Does that become the straw that breaks the Palestinian authorities back? It could. I think that's the danger that lies there. It didn't happen with the making the embassy, which really didn't move, but the embassy in Jerusalem didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen when Trump recognized the Golan Heights as Israel's sovereignty. Will it happen now? Hard to tell. The sad part is that the Palestinian cause has gained less and less support in the Arab world, is they have maybe more important things or more serious things since the Arab Spring, and I think that much of the Arab world sees Iran as the threat, and in fact they are allied with Israel, and the poor Palestinians get left behind.
I would imagine that all of this really would be contingent on whether or not Benjamin Netanyahu wins re-election and is actually able to fulfill any of these ideas. What is the current status of his election bid?
It's pretty close, like it was the last time. You know, the Israeli society is pretty evenly divided between, I would say 50%, but it's 60 votes because the Knesset is 120. About 50% of the country wants Israel to live up to its own stated, self-declared democratic principles and its Declaration of Independence. Not binding by law, but it's the founding document, and that's the Israel that most diaspora Jews like myself fell in love with. A democratic Israel, which is has freedom of religion, it's equal rights for all. And then the other half is totally concerned with security. Security is not an irrelevant issue in Israel. I mean, they fought for their life many times. But in the end, the Palestinians represent no existential threat to the existence of the state of Israel, especially in a two-state solution. There would be a demilitarized state, no airport, no seaports. Israel has total control over the air. It really doesn't pose that kind of a threat, and it's just which side will win. If the left wins, a left coalition, this idea of annexation will be a pipe dream and it'll be forgotten pretty quickly.
All right, that is Israel expert and author Rabbi Terry Bookman. Russian authorities launched a wave of police raids early Thursday, targeting supporters of opposition leader Alexei Navalny in dozens of cities across Russia. International Edition's Steve Miller talked about it with reporter Charles Main in Moscow.
So formerly, police linked the raids to an ongoing investigation into money laundering by Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation, which Russians know by its Russian acronyms, SVK, SVK, as they call it here. And supporters, of course, say these moves are aimed actually at paralyzing the organization's regional infrastructure. You know, the timing of this raid seemed highly political. It's coming right after Navalny backed a smart voting strategy during recent elections. This was a tactic that essentially coordinated voter anger around candidates who were most likely to beat the pro-Kremlin opponents. And it was credited with significant losses for candidates supported by the Kremlin in Moscow's most recent city council elections here.
How many raids are we talking about?
Well, the numbers that they're giving here is talking about 200 locations in 41 cities Russia-wide.
That is a massive effort.
It's a mass effort. It suggests it was a highly coordinated effort. Of course, these are in cities everywhere from Kaliningrad, that's in the east, I mean, in the far west of Russia, near the Baltic states, all the way to Vladivostok in its far east. So it's a very highly coordinated effort. Interesting also to note that several of the Navalny supporters in the regions immediately had their bank accounts blocked as well.
What was the rationale for that?
Well, again, there might be, formally the investigators say this is tied to these money laundering charges. Specifically, they've said that Navalny and the Navalny Anti-Corruption Foundation, again, FBK as it's called here in Russia, had basically money laundered about $15 million in illegal funds from outside sources without providing much evidence of that so far, but the investigation is ongoing. So presumably that's what these bank account blockages are tied to.
Alexei Navalny, has he made any comments about these raids or spoken out against them?
Yeah, he's released a blog post this morning. He said, if you wanted to know what this was about, he said two words: smart voting. This is, of course, a reference to his strategy, which led to these losses by Kremlin-backed candidates, that this essentially was revenge for a scenario that they played out in Moscow with a numbers game that won them several races here locally. But Navalny's chief strategist, a guy named Leonid Volkov, noted that this was essentially stage one of this strategy at the rollout. And once they were getting ready to do smart voting efforts in regional races come 2020 and 2021, when we have Duma elections here for the parliament, that this eventually was almost guaranteed to somehow usurp power from the ruling United Russia Party and from pro-Kremlin candidates. So in a sense, this was a way to lash back at regional efforts to do that in the future.
You know, this is coming after, the Election Commission barred several opposition-oriented candidates from actually running. The elections took place. There are protests. What are people on the street, reacting to this? What are they saying?
Well, they're still trying to digest it. We just learned about this morning. So most of the information is, of course, being traded on social media, where we hear about from representatives in the region saying, that the police are at their door or breaking down their door. I was in touch personally with one of Navalny's associates in Nizhny Novgorod. This is in the west of Russia, who said the police had first come to his mother's house. This is another kind of trend of police raids, that they came for not only the actual Navalny affiliate, associates, but their families as well. So they were intimidating his mother, and he was waiting for the police to arrive at his apartment. So we've seen, a big diverse, and finally I should add that they've also been going to the actual, of course, Navalny offices, and using doing those as well, where they've been taking computer equipment. They've also been cutting power to the offices in advance so that video monitoring systems can't record what happens inside. And so it seems really an effort to paralyze the organization completely.
All right, that's Charles Main in Moscow speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. A Tanzanian journalist arrested in July after criticizing the president in print appeared in court today, or actually Thursday, looking weak and having trouble walking. Erica Kabendera is facing several charges, or Eric Kabendera is facing several charges, including sedition. Charles Kombe has the story from Dar es Salaam.
Prospects for Tanzanian journalist Eric Kabendera's release were dashed the Thursday when the government prosecutor said the investigation against him is still in process. Kabendera had trouble walking when he entered the court chamber. His lawyer, Jebra Kambole, says the plan for his medical treatment is unclear. He says the agenda for Eric's treatment has become a major challenge for the court, which has been informed that Eric's health status is not good. The lawyer said the magistrate issued instructions, including meeting with a prison doctor for health checkup. Kambole said another hearing on September 18th will look at Kabendera's health status, and the court may issue more instructions at that time. The 39-year-old Kabendera was arrested at the end of July at his home amid questions about his citizenship. Later, the charges were changed, and he was accused of sedition, money laundering, and organized crime. Kabendera's work has been published in national and international newspapers. He regularly covers Africa's politics, trade, and extractive industry for leading publications, including The Guardian and The Times, both based in Britain. After Kabendera was arrested, Kambole said his client was facing sedition charges in connection with an article in The Economist in which Kabendera said President Magufuli is bulldozing Tanzania's freedom. Earlier this month, the Committee to Protect Journalists included Kabendera on its 10 most urgent cases that require global attention. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA News Feed. VOAnews.com.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. The traditional three-hour Ethiopian coffee ceremony is the stuff of legends dating back to the 9th century. It's a ritual that includes washing the beans, roasting them over hot coals, removing the oils, and grinding the beans before preparing the coffee and serving it with popcorn for honored guests three times. Ethiopia is one of few coffee-producing nations where locals consume large quantities of the country's largest export. It contributes more than two-thirds of the national income, and coffee in Ethiopia is more than just a commodity. It is a cornerstone of the culture. One of Ethiopia's most successful businesswomen owns a small chain of Starbucks-style cafes. And they're not just for affluent Ethiopians. Reporter Amy Gutman just visited Ethiopia and joins us to talk more about it. You actually have discovered something in Ethiopia where, rather than complaining about some of China's footprints in Africa, some are capitalizing on it.
That's correct. I met one of Ethiopia's most successful businesswomen, a woman named Bethlehem Alimu. Bethlehem Alimu owns a small chain of Starbucks-style cafes, and they're very Western in every aspect of them, and they're called Garden of Coffee. So they offer things like avocado toast and other familiar meals that you might find in places like New York or L.A. But Lehman's customers aren't only affluent Ethiopians and Anglo expats. Her customers also include a lot of the Chinese people who are either based in Ethiopia doing full-time work there or are just flying in on business. They also include Koreans and other Asians sent to Ethiopia on business trips or extended work stays.
So how is she using those customers to gain more market share and expand?
Well, they adore her coffee, mostly because what's unique about it is that it's single origin. And obviously, Ethiopia is one of the largest coffee-producing countries in the world. And in places like Korea, people are very knowledgeable about coffee and where coffee comes from. So they're familiar with some of the coffee-producing towns in Ethiopia. In fact, some of these places have achieved an almost cult-like status among coffee drinkers all over Asia. So this businesswoman has built such a strong following, not only by feeding Asian customers who are doing business in Ethiopia or there on extended work stays, but also by being very savvy with PR. So she's conducted an entire media and press campaign in China to, again, raise her profile, cultivate future customers. So she has done such a good job at flipping this whole China-Africa story on its head that she actually has plans to expand to China next year and open 100 stores, 100 coffee shops by 2022. And she only has 2 coffee shops in Ethiopia's capital right now. So she will actually have a much bigger brand in China than her own home country.
All right, reporter Amy Gutman, thank you for being with us. Well, as Madonna gets ready to kick off her Madame X tour, she is laying down some strict rules for her shows. Fans got a serious memo outlining a new policy prohibiting cell phones, and the message said absolutely no exceptions. The notice told ticket holders that their phones and smartwatches would be held in secure cases until the end of the concert, and people caught sneaking them in would be kicked out. Interestingly, Madonna is apparently notorious for bringing her cell phone to shows and concerts and even texting while attending the events. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. And you keep on trying to do it, baby. I'm gonna switch your plans on you. Cause you're driving me crazy. You must think I'm crazy. Você me põe tão louca. Você pensa que eu sou louca. And I won't let you drive me crazy. I won't let you drive me crazy. Você não vai me põe tão louca. It's a shame on you. Say now if you think I've been foolish and you keep on trying to do it, baby, I'ma switch your plans on you. Cause you're driving me crazy. You must think I'm crazy. Você me põe tão louca. Você pensa que eu sou louca. And I won't let you drive me crazy.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.